National Sugar Corporation in 1941. It was guys like him who got the company indicted. Are you saying that this newspaper belongs to JT's father? I started to answer, then stopped. Actually, I'm not saying anything. And neither is JT. Except to point out once again that the only item listed in the search warrant is a cell phone. She walked across the room and laid the newspaper on the nightstand. Keep looking, she told the officer. This is a waste of time, I said. You know JT doesn't have the phone, and you know he's not the killer. JT was right here under house arrest with a bracelet on this ankle when the last victim was murdered. She looked at me from across the room, but I still felt it. JT was under house arrest when the last victim was found. The medical examiner puts her time of death at least 2 days before JT went under house arrest. I suddenly realized why it had been so difficult to compare Angelina's photograph to the face of the victim. After that much time in the Everglades, bloating and decomposition could make facial recognition problematic. Santos walked toward me again. Do you know where your brother-in-law was on that night? I didn't answer. I didn't think so, she said. Bag the newspaper, she told the officer. As far as I'm concerned, it's evidence. We'll let the judge decide if it's admissible. Chapter 47.
I got the newspaper from Samantha, JT said.
It was just JT and me in his TV room. The police were gone, no cell phone. They'd left only with the old copy of the Miami Tribune. I gathered up the couch cushions from the floor, arranged them exactly as they'd been before the search, and told JT to have a seat. He ignored me and took his beanbag chair.
It's your fucking couch, Abe. You sit on it.
I did. When you say you got it from Samantha, do you mean it was left behind here, like the couch and all the other furniture, and you happened to find it when you moved in? Or do you mean she literally gave it to you?
It was a gift, he said.
When did she give it to you?
Right before she went into the hospital,
he said, then swallowed.
The last time she went in?
Not our favorite subject.
Tell me what happened.
He groaned, pressing the heels of his palms to his eyes, clearly not wanting to make this journey. JT, this is very important.
All right,
he said in an angry voice. I gave him a minute. He collected himself.
She told me she probably wasn't coming home again.
He paused to catch his breath.
She says, JT, Mama's gone, Devin's gone, Daddy won't be here much longer. When I go, that leaves you.
Devin was the older brother whom I'd never met.
Go on, I said. That's when she told me the story, he said.
What story?
The fucking story in the newspaper, Abe. My old man was one of the men that the sugar companies brought down from Memphis like slaves. It's part of our family. It's a piece of history. We need to keep it. Pass it on. Let people know that fucking slavery didn't end in 1865.
Where did she get the newspaper?
Where do you think?
She said there was other stuff, too. Other stuff?
Yeah, Luther had all kinds of crap from when he cut cane. The sugar company made him buy it with his own money, a blanket, all that gear and equipment. He's such a cheap son of a bitch. He paid for it, so he kept it.
I remembered that part of the story. Before the first row of cane was cut, the men were so far in debt that they could never leave the plantation. As I recalled, they'd also made each worker buy a machete. I didn't go there, not specifically.
Where's the other stuff?
I don't know, Abe. She gave me the newspaper article and said more shit was in a box somewhere. I never looked for it. Samantha says I needed to pass it on to the next generation. But who the hell am I gonna pass anything on to, Abe?
Did Samantha tell you where that box is?
It's with all my old man's shit. I don't know where. Whatever happened to it when you guys moved him into the nursing home?
Finally, a question I could answer. It's in mini storage, I said. Along with some other personal items of Samantha's, things that I couldn't bring myself to just donate to Goodwill, and that I knew Angelina wouldn't want around our house.
Then that's where it is, said JT. In storage. But why does it matter? Why does any of this matter?
It doesn't, I said. JT popped up from the beanbag, pacing.
It matters to Santos. That bitch is crazy. She comes to my house last night asking questions like you was the one who killed Angelina. Now she comes to my house with a search warrant acting like I killed her. Or maybe she thinks I killed all these women. Is that what she thinks, Abe?
JT, relax. She doesn't think you killed anyone. She's putting pressure on you in order to put pressure on me.
So she doesn't think I did anything?
No.
She thinks you did it?
I looked away from JT toward the middle distance. Honestly, I don't know what she thinks anymore. I rose from the couch and dug my car keys from my pocket.
Where you going?
Asked JT. Nowhere, I said, as I headed for the door. He followed me.
What do you mean, nowhere? You're going somewhere.
I pulled the door open. Get some sleep, JT. He grabbed me by the arm.
Where you going, Abe?
I said nothing, but my expression was stern enough to make him release my arm. I'm going to get some answers. Lock the door and go to sleep. I didn't wait for daylight. AAA mini storage was open 24 hours, 7 days a week. I drove home, got the key to the unit, and went to the warehouse. The five-story building was deserted, more like a mausoleum. Sensors triggered the lights in the lobby as I entered. Pod 403 was on the fourth floor. The elevator was out of service, so I walked up. Technically, the building was air-conditioned, but I was breaking a sweat in the stairwell. More sweat as I walked down the hallway. Maybe it was the stale air. Maybe it was nerves. I unlocked the garage-style metal door and rolled it open. It was cooler inside the unit than in the hallway, but that was my only sense of relief. Memory stared back at me, making it difficult to enter. My last visit to Pod 403 had been about 6 months after Samantha's funeral. Some of her things I had given away, some things I felt like I should keep, though not necessarily keep around the house, especially after I started dating Angelina. Carmen had gone through the same exercise with the passing of her husband. She told me to tackle one drawer, one closet at a time, and to create three piles: the save pile, the donation trash pile, and the not sure what I want to do with it pile. It was a fine line between save and not sure. On the one hand, it was pointless to save a framed college diploma, but it represented 4 years of Samantha's life. And what about the enormous dollhouse that Luther had made for her with his own two hands, and that Samantha had been saving for her own daughter? I stepped into the unit and saw the boxes I'd packed so carefully, still not sure what to do with these things. They had all ended up in Pod 403, along with the personal effects that Samantha had gathered from Luther's apartment when he went to the nursing home. Samantha had sealed up the boxes, etched Luther's name on them with a black marker, and stored them in our garage. I had never looked inside any of those boxes. They had remained sealed from the day Samantha had packed them. When Samantha died, Luther Vine was the bulk of my not sure pile, but it was mostly procrastination on my part. I had planned to go through them someday. This was the day. The boxes were stacked floor to ceiling on the left. I started at the top, taking two boxes at a time into the hallway, cutting through the tape with the key. Some of Luther's stuff I had no idea why Samantha had kept. Who needs a TV guide from 1972? My guess was that she'd packed up his entire apartment without deciding what to save and what to discard. If Luther kept something, it was important. I understood. It was a safe bet that 10 minutes after throwing out that TV guide, Samantha would have gotten an urgent phone call from the nursing home. Hey, whatever happened to that 1972? The ninth box got my attention, but only after I'd pulled it down from the very top of the fourth stack of boxes. On the side that had been shoved against the wall and hidden from sight, in black letters, Samantha had written, Luther Vine, 1941. Save. I carried the box into the hallway and placed it on the floor. The sharp edge of the key ripped through the tape. I peeled open the flaps. It had all the anticipation of opening a time capsule, except that I knew exactly what I was looking for. An old blanket was on top, neatly folded. I removed it and laid it on the floor. Beneath it, I found the loose collection of things. Some were easily recognizable, and I removed those first. A water canteen, a lunch pail, a pair of work gloves, heavy boots with steel toes. Other things I had to examine more closely to figure out what they were. A pair of metal knee guards, wrist shields. There was even a badge with Luther's name on it, which identified him as an employee of the National Sugar Corporation. The wage record and task log was interesting. It said that Luther cut 43 tons of cane his first week on the job. He owed the company $19.27. I emptied the box completely. Luther's dark piece of history laid out across the floor. I went back inside the unit and searched for more boxes, but there was just the one from 1941. I looked a second time. I was there till midnight. I found no cane-cutting knife. Chapter 48. I should have gone to bed, but sleep was out of the question. Part of me wanted to go see Luther and ask what had happened to his machete. There were two problems with that. One, he was surely asleep at this hour. Two, he probably had no memory of it. For all I knew, he'd lost it doing yard work when Truman was president. Get a good night's sleep. That had been Carmen's advice. I was supposed to sit for another polygraph examination in the morning, one with better questions. I needed to be rested and ready for it. But I was tired of other people dictating my needs. I needed to find my wife. Monday was half an hour old when I reached Little Havana. I parked down the street from Pond 24, which of course was open for business. From the sidewalk, through the iron security bars over the plate glass window, I could see Manny with a client at the counter. They were haggling over the loan value on a stolen wristwatch or some such thing. I didn't go inside. Manny and his uncle had already given us all the help they were willing to give. Manny had reviewed dozens of photographs at the police station, and not one of them was the guy who had sold him Samantha's ring. The police had walked the streets for hours and asked every homeless person in the neighborhood about the ring. Nothing. The problem was that the police had done their search in the afternoon, not after midnight, when the sale had been made. They had told me to leave the investigation to them. But we were beyond that 48-hour mark since Angelina had gone missing. No leads. My choice was to lie in bed awake or give it a shot myself. It was an easy decision. Hey, got a second? I asked the first guy I saw. He was standing in the recessed doorway of a farmacia that had closed at midnight, straightening out his bed of cardboard.
Get lost, he grumbled. This is my spot.
I handed him a couple bucks and flashed a photograph of Samantha's ring on my iPhone. Know anyone selling a ring like this?
Nope.
I flashed a photo of Angelina. I'm looking for this woman. He looked closely as if he might actually want to help, then turned away.
Don't waste your time. Lousiest blowjob I ever got.
This wasn't going to be easy. The next six conversations were even less productive, and not because my Spanish was marginal. The seventh guy grabbed my phone. I managed to hang on to it, but he wouldn't let go until I pushed him to the ground.
Asshole! Why'd you hand me the phone if you don't want me to have it?
He stayed down, which made me feel even worse. He reminded me a little of JT. I was heading back to my car when I spotted a woman outside a cigar shop. Her world was wrapped in a green garbage bag inside the shopping cart that she pushed along the sidewalk.
Ask you a question?
She stopped, seemingly surprised that I'd spoken to her. I showed her the photograph of the ring and asked the same question I'd asked the others.
Jorko sold that, she said.
My turn to be surprised. What did you say?
My friend Jorko sold a diamond ring like that.
When?
This weekend. $500, or so he says. Shithead wouldn't give me 10 cents, so I calls him a liar.
My heart was pounding. Is your friend dangerous?
If you were dangerous, would you let people call you Jorko?
That made sense, but he didn't exactly sound like a prime suspect in my wife's disappearance. How do I find this Jorko? She raised an eyebrow, negotiating.
How bad do you want to find him?
I'll give you $10. I didn't want to appear too eager.
I wouldn't tell you what city he's in for $10.
To hell with looking eager. How much then?
50. I'll take you right where he sleeps. 20
to take me to his spot, I said, fishing the bill from my wallet. 50 if he's actually there. She snatched the 20 from my hand.
Done.
I offered to push her cart, but she would have sooner cut off her arm. Or mine. She led and I followed behind the rattle of the wheels on the cracked sidewalk. This stretch of Calle Ocho was a one-way street, still a couple miles from downtown Miami, but we were headed in that direction. We walked 5 blocks, and just as the journey was starting to seem pointless, she stopped outside El Presidente supermarket. Across the street was a vacant lot. A huge for sale sign said it was suitable for commercial or residential, approved for 323 units. My gaze drifted beyond the chain-link fence toward the far corner of the lot, where the homeless had decided not to wait for the approved units to be built.
He's over there, she said.
You need to point him out to me if you want your money, I said.
Cheapskate,
she muttered. I followed her across the street, and she knew exactly where to find the unauthorized opening in the chain-link fence, which was more than big enough to accommodate her cart. The ground was packed hard, patches of grass and weeds here and there. Bulldozers had left a few trees standing across the back of the lot, and the farther away from the street we walked, the more homeless we saw. Cardboard houses stood beneath the trees. Sheets of plastic served as blankets. The pungent odor of urine wafted from behind the bushes. If I squinted, turning the night into grainy black and white footage, it was like a scene from The Grapes of Wrath. At the very back of the lot were several picnic tables, presumably stolen from a nearby park and brought here for shelter. We were beyond the glow of streetlights, but in the moonlight, I saw the silhouette of a man lying on the ground beneath one of the tables.
That's him, she said.
I started toward the table, but she stopped me.
You owe me $30,
she said. I kept my end of the deal. 10 more. If you'll make a nice introduction. She smiled, took the extra 10, and shouted into the darkness,
Hey, asshole! There's a fucking idiot here to see you.
She stuffed the money into one of her many pockets and pushed her cart across the lot, back toward Calle Ocho. The man stirred and then sat up, but he didn't come out from under the picnic table. I made a quick judgment. I knew I wasn't dealing with Cutter,
a serial killer with the wherewithal to dump multiple victims in the Palm Beach County cane fields 90 miles from here, and to avoid detection for over 2 months. In theory, it was still possible that this was the man who had taken my wife, perhaps even killed her. But something told me that if Jerko had indeed pawned Samantha's ring, he'd come into possession of it secondhand, maybe even third. I went with my gut and operated from that premise. "Can I talk to you?" I said, walking toward him.
"Stay where you are!"
I stopped a few feet away. Slowly, I lowered myself into a crouch. We were at eye level, but in the shadows beneath the table, his face was barely visible. "Your friend says you sold the diamond ring this weekend."
"She's not my friend."
"Notice avowal of the sale. Can you tell me where you got the ring?"
"Can you go fuck yourself?"
Jerko was indeed a jerk. "Look, pal, I'm not a cop. I'm not here to make trouble for you. I just need some information." He didn't answer, and I still couldn't read his face. He was shrouded in total darkness beneath the table, the trees overhead. "Just tell me how you got the ring," I said. "I'll pay you for your help."
"How much?"
I was running out of cash. $20.
$100.
I don't have that much on me. I wasn't lying.
"I'll take your phone."
"I can't give you my phone."
"Then I can't help you."
Patience, I told myself, but the anger was working its way up from somewhere deep inside, unstoppable. "Tell me where you got the ring," I said. It was a voice so threatening that I barely recognized it as my own. It was fair warning to him, even if he couldn't see the anger in my eyes.
"Hand over your phone," he said.
"I don't have one."
"Everybody has one."
I opened my wallet, dug out all my cash. "I'll give you $60.
"And your phone."
On another night, I might have played his game, or at least called for a squad car and done this by the book. But my wife was missing, and after Tyler's murder, JT's house arrest, and a mountain of aggravation from Agent Santos, something snapped. I lunged at him, grabbed him by the shirt, and pulled him from under the table. He was much smaller than me, and in no time, I had him face down under control. I was sitting on his kidneys, my hand at the base of his skull, pushing his forehead into the ground.
"Don't hurt me,"
he said, pleading. I grabbed his greasy hair and jerked his head back.
"You want my phone?"
I said in a harsh voice.
"Here's my phone. Look, you son of a bitch. Look at this picture."
I held his head still, the phone in my free hand. Angelina's headshot was right before his eyes.
"Look at her."
"What do you know about this woman?" It was a demand, not a question. He didn't answer. I shoved his face into the ground. They yanked his head back far enough to see Angelina's photo again.
"What do you know?"
I shouted.
"That's her,"
he said.
"That's who?"
"That's the woman who asked me to pawn the ring."
"Don't lie to me." "I'm not lying. She said if I went inside the pawn shop and sold the ring for her, I could keep $50.
"That's a damn lie."
"It's the truth."
His body was shaking beneath my weight. I tightened my grip on his hair. "Don't you dare lie to me." His body was no longer shaking. These were seismic undulations, the difference between 5.0 and 7.0 on the Richter scale. He was crying uncontrollably.
"I'm not lying. It was her. That's the lady."
I felt my grip loosen and his hair slip through my fingers. His chin dropped and he was crying into the dirt. I climbed to my feet and stood over him, not knowing what to think.
"If I find out you hurt that woman in the picture, I will."
"I never touched her. I just sold a stupid ring."
I wanted to call him a liar, a
bald-faced liar, but my head was spinning and the accusations wouldn't come. I grabbed him by the collar and pulled him to his feet.
What are you doing, man?
I held a tight hold on his shirt, forcing him to walk with me. He was half jogging to keep up as we crossed the vacant lot to the hole in the fence. He was too scared, too tired, and too much of a wimp to resist.
Where are you taking me?
I didn't answer, but we were less than 2 blocks from Pawn 24. I'd seen Manny through the window earlier, so I knew he was working the early AM shift. It took less than a minute to get there, even while dragging Jerko along with me. I rang the bell outside the entrance. Manny came to the door, but I didn't wait for him to unlock it. I shoved Jerko's face against the glass, and with the other hand, I showed my badge. Manny seemed startled for a moment, but he recognized me from that morning.
Is this the guy?
I shouted.
Is this who sold you the ring?
Manny studied the man's face through the glass. Only a few seconds were needed. Then he nodded.
I'll give the money back to you,
said Jerko.
Just don't hurt me, okay?
I pulled him away from the door and forced him to sit on the sidewalk.
Don't you move an inch,
I said, dialing Rid's number. We're going to find out what the hell is going on. Chapter 49. Jerko sobbed and cried, begging me to let him go, right up until the Miami-Dade police arrived and put him in the back of the squad car. I followed in my car to the station. Rid met us there, but he immediately took me out of the loop. I found a bench in the hallway and waited outside the interrogation room while Rid and another detective did their teamwork. Just before 1 a.m., the door opened and Rid came to me. Jerko has no idea what happened to Angelina, he said. It was hard to know if that was good or bad news.
Are you sure?
There are older detectives here, Abe, but I've been doing this a while, long enough to know. But don't get me wrong. This guy is a piece of shit.
Tell me.
He's a registered sex offender in the state of New York. That was his last known address.
What was his offense?
Multiple acts of sexual misconduct. Apparently, he's a huge fan of high school girls' soccer. So long as he can stand on the other side of the fence and jerk off. Finally, a definitive explanation for the name Jerko. It hardly put me at ease.
But if he's a sex offender, doesn't that make him even more of a suspect?
Abe, here's the situation. Your wife and Samantha's ring were missing. But there's no sign of any breaking at your house. One possibility is that the perp was someone she knew and Angelina let him in.
Or he lived there, I said. Agent Santos' theory.
Right, said Rid. Or he was a stranger and had a key. That's why we've been checking every conceivable place Angelina may have valeted her car for the last month to see if anyone copied her house key. Jerko doesn't exactly fit the profile of someone who could get his hands on a key to your house, much less someone who'd manage to find Samantha's ring and make your wife vanish, all without leaving a shred of evidence.
Then how did Jerko get the ring?
I don't know. He said he got it from Angelina. That's his story, and he's sticking to it, said Rid. He's obviously lying, covering for a friend, or afraid to name names. Is it really obvious that it's a lie? It is to me. I walked to the bench, tried to sit, but my mind was racing. I went right back at Rid. Isn't it possible that he got the ring from Angelina? He sighed, exasperated. Abe, I just walked you through the likely scenarios. Someone she knew or a stranger who had a key. What about the unlikely scenarios?
I paused, careful to deliver this properly.
What if she just left?
Just took off?
Middle of the night, poof. That's what you're saying?
Yeah.
Why in the hell would she do that?
To teach me a lesson.
Rid scoffed.
Abe, you need some sleep.
I'm serious, Rid. Hear me out.
It's always bugged Angelina the way I hung on to Samantha's memory. Suddenly she disappears, and the only thing missing from the house is Samantha's jewelry, including her engagement ring, which is hocked at a Little Havana pawn shop for a fraction of its value. Isn't that sending a message? Get this worthless thing out of our house.
Abe, it's been a long week. You're really tired.
And to top it off, Angelina's ring was left sitting on the dresser. What thief would climb all the way up to the top shelf in the closet for Samantha's rings, but leave the low-hanging fruit right on the dresser?
It's odd, okay, I give you that.
But there has to be a better explanation than Angelina trying to teach you a lesson.
Not one I can think of. And I've been thinking about this a lot. She even said it herself one time, that I'd miss her when she was gone.
That's when I'd appreciate her. A couple officers walked by us in the hall. Rid waited for them to pass, then shook his head at me.
Abe, drop this.
You're hoping your wife is alive and safe. That's natural. And the thought that Angelina up and left you is a lot better scenario than some of the other possibilities that must be going through your mind. But don't go sharing this theory with anyone but me.
Why are you so closed-minded?
Because if you weren't shell-shocked and sleep-deprived, I'd say it's the most egotistical thing any man has ever said.
What are you talking about?
First off, it's fucking crazy to say your wife went missing just to make you appreciate her more. I know Angelina has a temper, and she even popped you in the nose when you left her for Samantha, but unless there's some really abusive shit going on between you two, there's not, I said. Fine, there's not. But for argument's sake, let's say Angelina is the nuttiest fruitcake on the block and has a mile-long mean streak. You saw Angelina's parents on TV tonight. I know you saw her mother practically falling apart in front of the camera. The idea that Angelina would do this to her own mother and father just to teach you a lesson is, Abe, it's...
I could have waited for him to finish his thought, but it wasn't necessary.
Unthinkable, I offered.
That would be my word for it, said Rid.
Mine too. Maybe I did need sleep.
Okay, that's valid. But the fact remains that Jerko ended up with the ring. I showed him the picture of Angelina on my phone. He admitted that he got it from her. He told you the same thing.
Yeah, he did, but...
But what?
He took me by the arm, pulling me toward the interrogation room.
Come inside with me.
What for?
You want to know why it's bullshit that Jerko got the ring straight from your wife?
I'll show you.
He opened the door and I followed him inside. Jerko was seated across the table from another Miami-Dade detective. He recoiled at the sight of me, the memory of our earlier discussion still fresh. I stood in the corner by the door. Rid crossed the room and leaned on the table, staring Jerko down. There was a manila file on the tabletop. Rid opened it. I couldn't see what was inside, and until he put his question to Jerko, I didn't know it was a photograph.
Is this the woman who asked you to pawn the ring?
Asked Rid. Jerko nodded quickly, nervously.
Yeah, that's her. That's the woman.
Rid tucked the photograph into the file and brought it with him as he led me back into the hallway, the door closing behind us. Then he showed me the photograph. I blinked, confused. It looks like Charlize Theron.
It is Charlize Theron.
Jerko said the same thing when we showed him Reese Witherspoon 15 minutes ago, and Kirsten Dunst 10 minutes before that.
They're all beautiful blonde women, just like your wife in the picture you showed him. And they all asked him to pawn the ring.
Whatever remained inside of me quickly drained away.
All the excitement of a solid lead, all the hope of a break in the investigation. But clearly he got the ring from somebody.
From somebody?
But not from Angelina. Not if you ask me. I checked the clock on the wall, almost 2 a.m.
It's late, I said.
Get some sleep, said Rid. You have a polygraph exam in 7 hours. I took a deep breath, then let it out.
Yeah.
Maybe this time I should study.
Chapter 50. I slept for 3 hours, but no more. I could have stayed in bed and stared at JT's ceiling for the next 2 hours. Instead, I got up, showered, and drove to Sunny Garden Nursing Home. Luther was an early riser, and each passing year pushed back the hands on his internal alarm clock. 6 a.m., no problem. Hell, it was practically his lunchtime. When I walked into his room, he was sitting in a chair by the window, wide awake and dressed, his flannel shirt buttoned all the way up to his Adam's apple. Even better, he was himself.
Well, shut my mouth, it's Mr. Lincoln.
Don't get up, I said.
Don't worry.
I smiled as if there were nothing wrong, but in Luther's mind, there wasn't. I hadn't said a word to him about Angelina, and he was the antithesis of a news junkie. If it wasn't on ESPN, it didn't exist. I pulled up another chair.
How are you, old man? Old? That about covers it.
It just about did. Half of the time, he couldn't remember that I had remarried. So even under the best of circumstances, any mention of Angelina was confusing to him. A conversation about her disappearance would surely have gone off the rails. After Samantha died, I'd wondered how long it might be till the next funeral, thinking it would be Luther's. I sure as hell didn't think it would be for my second wife. There was a noise in the hallway right outside the open door to Luther's room. I craned my neck for a glimpse and saw the paramedics wheeling a gurney out of the room across the hall. A white sheet covered the body. I went to close the door, but Luther stopped me.
We lose someone?
He asked.
Looks that way.
Across the hall.
Oh, that's Barbara. Sad, sad, sad. Not her time.
How old was she?
94.
I looked away, then back. No offense, Luther, but she was 94 years old. Not her time.
I know what you think. She's old. She's ready. But she wasn't. Ready, I mean.
Did she want to make it to 100?
No, no. Barbara wished herself to death 50 years ago.
She did what? He leaned forward and looked at me in the eye, even if he did have that one eye that kind of pointed off in another direction.
Pay attention, boy. There's a difference between wanting to die and being ready to die.
I thought about it and decided he was making sense. Why wasn't she ready?
Same reason she wished she was dead.
Broken heart.
How did her heart get broken?
He sat back, arms folded.
I ain't got a clue.
Then how do you know she had one?
I'm as old as Noah. I know a broken heart when I see it. Yes, sir. That heart stopped beating last night. But Barbara died a long, long time ago.
That's sad.
Nothing sadder.
Again, he leaned closer, this time raising a finger to make his point.
You know what I always say, don't you, Abe?
I nodded. Ain't no shame in dying. And then Luther finished it.
But it's a crying shame to die of a broken heart.
I could have slipped away right then, let my mind drift back to the first time I'd heard Luther tell me about broken hearts. But I refused to go there.
Luther pointed at the pitcher on the tray.
Pour me some water there, would you?
Sure.
I got up and filled his cup. The sound inside of it made me think of the tap he'd run up at the National Sugar Corporation, as recorded on 70-year-old task sheets and pay stubs I'd seen earlier at the warehouse. The company had charged him for water that wasn't too dirty to drink. Part of the $19 he owed at the end of the first week of cutting cane. I handed him his cup and returned to my chair.
Luther, have we ever talked about your days of cutting sugar cane?
He steadied his cup and sipped from it.
Probably not.
You mind if I ask about it?
What you want to know?
I found a box that Samantha kept.
It had some old things in it from when you cut cane. His eyes brightened a bit, not from the memory of the cane fields, but from my mention of his daughter's name.
Samantha said that stuff belonged in a museum. I guess she never got anyone interested in having it.
I guess not, it's all still there, I said, pausing just a second before getting to the real point.
All except the machete.
My cutting knife not there?
No. Everything else. But not the knife.
Damn. I paid $1.50 for that knife. Another 50 cents for the file.
It made me think of JT's remark. He paid for it, he was going to keep it.
Luther, I want you to think very hard. When is the last time you saw that knife?
Hell, I don't know.
Was it after you cut cane for National Sugar? I just want to know if you're sure you brought it home from the camp.
Oh, I'm sure. If there was anything worth keeping, it was the knife.
Okay. That's helpful. Now think about this before you answer. Did you keep the knife with all the other things from your cane cutting days?
I ain't seen that stuff in years, Abe.
I know, it's been a long time, but this is important. Is it possible you kept the knife somewhere else? A toolbox? A shed?
Possible, I guess.
Could it have gotten lost somewhere? Or thrown away? Maybe even someone stole it?
When?
Anytime.
Shit, Abe, we're talking more than 70 years.
I know, I said, my tone more urgent than I intended.
But I need to know. Is it possible?
Abe, of course it's possible. This goes back before the Second World War. Who knows where that knife ended up? Could be anywhere.
I sat back and took a breath. It was the best answer he could give me, and it was the reality of the situation, whether I liked it or not.
You're right, I said.
Anywhere. Chapter 51. A pre-dawn fog crept across the darkness of Shadowwood Park. In silence, Victoria and a SWAT unit of 8 rode in the rear compartment of a special response vehicle. The tip had come from an alert customer at a self-serve gas station. The tipster, a Vietnam veteran, had been driving all night from Tallahassee. He pulled up behind a sedan, climbed out of his truck, and squeezed between his front bumper and the back of the other vehicle on his way to the pump.
I smelled plenty of dead bodies in Nam, he told police. You don't forget it.
That was what I smelled coming from the trunk of that car. The hope was that the body was not Angelina's, that Angelina was still alive and in the house. Any potential hostage situation called for action far more drastic than a car search. The FBI opted for a tactical response. Shadowwood Park was adjacent to the suspect's house in a quiet subdivision. It was a typical 1970s development in northwest Broward County, where homeowners chose from one of four models. Bulldozers came in, good schools were built, and in 2 years, 1,000 ranch-style single-family homes stood where the Everglades had once flowed. It was a strategic decision for SWAT to launch before sunrise, and the park offered the added cover of 40-year-old trees and overgrown bushes. It was the designated staging area for the SWAT assault. The vehicle stopped. Team leader Kyle Crawford ran through the pre-launch checklist. The SWAT C-33 was a dual-purpose vehicle that delivered tactical support and served as a mobile command platform for response team planning and communications. A night vision field camera mounted on Crawford's helmet would provide live video feed to a monitor inside the vehicle. Two other team members, breachers, the first to enter, also had cameras. A Bowen microphone and headset provided audio communication. Victoria would be in constant contact with the team while watching the operation unfold in real time, through their eyes. Crawford's checklist was finished. The rear doors opened and the team filed out. The intensity was palpable, even if they were still in pre-launch mode. A second SWAT unit had followed in a separate vehicle and joined them. Dressed all in black, faces covered with grease paint, the units were virtually invisible in the darkness. Victoria was armed only with her standard Sig Sauer 9mm sidearm, but plenty more firepower would go in before her. Team members carried fully automatic M16s. Kevlar vests, helmets, and countless hours of training and experience would protect them from whatever might come in return. A third vehicle arrived. Victoria's communications specialist and two forensic agents caught up with the team and went inside the mobile command center. Crawford gave a hand signal. SWAT 1 deployed in silent unison. Peering through night vision goggles, Victoria watched the first wave of SWAT members fan out around the perimeter of the quarter-acre lot as they surrounded the suspect in his house. Mature olive trees partially blocked her view, but she could see the front yard, the walkway, and the front of the house. The windows were black, no sign of any lights burning inside. But a bug light on the porch cast an eerie amber pall. Crawford adjusted his earpiece. He was getting audio from Team One. "Stand by," Crawford told his team. 10 seconds to video. Victoria went back inside the vehicle. The communications specialist was seated in front of 5 separate monitors, each linked to a different field camera. Victoria watched over his shoulder. Crawford and 2 other SWAT members joined her. The first monitor flickered, then fixed on an image. It was from the surveillance agents, the first to approach the house. Theirs was that all-important job of scoping out the scene in stealth from outside the walls. They had already pulled the building plans and confirmed the floor plan for this particular model, which the team had reviewed and memorized. Infrared cameras couldn't see through brick walls or glass, but winter in Florida was the season for open windows. If the agents could find one, heat sensors would tell them if anyone was inside. "Video confirmed," Victoria said into her microphone. "Go ahead, over."
"Building plans are accurate," the surveillance agent reported. "No structural alterations detected. 2 small bedrooms on south side of the house, both vacant. Kitchen, dining, and TV room on the east side, also vacant. Infrared sensor confirms 1 subject in master bedroom north side. Large, probably male, appears to be sleeping. Direct access through sliding glass doors facing rear screened-in patio. Over."
"Any sign of 2nd subject, over."
By subject, Victoria meant victim. They were looking for a serial killer, and Angelina was still missing.
"Can't get a visual? Infrared scan shows amorphous glow from master bathroom. Some source of heat."
Victoria leaned closer to the monitor. The image was weak, but the description had been accurate. Victoria had worked with infrared in many cases before, and she'd seen similar low-level glows from victims found in dumpsters or hidden in the weeds. A human body could continue to give off detectable levels of warmth at least 2 or 3 hours after death. Crawford went team-wide on his microphone. "Stand by," he said, not a hint of emotion in his voice. On 3 were yellow. Yellow was the SWAT code for the final position of cover and concealment.
Green was the assault, the moment of life and death, literally. Crawford exited the communications van and joined the rest of Team 2. Victoria could no longer see him, but the image from the camera mounted on Crawford's helmet flashed on screen 2. Images from other field cameras flashed on monitors 3, 4, and 5. Victoria had the total picture, and she had Crawford's command in her ear. 3, 2, 1. The monitor showed SWAT on the move, a silent and well-choreographed wave through the woods, out of the park, and into the yard. Victoria could almost feel their steps, toes first, then heels, knees bent to absorb the recoil in case they were forced to fire. Monitor 2 captured the approach from the east to cover the back door. Monitor 3 showed street-side containment, SWAT within striking distance of the front door, but not too close, the approach coming to a stop just behind the reach of the glowing yellow porch light. Crawford and two others went around to the patio, but his camera feed wasn't clear. The fog and the patio screens made for a blur on the monitor, which only added to Victoria's anxiety. She wondered about that ghostly aura of warmth emanating from the bathroom. The images froze. Movement had stopped. A round of microphone checks confirmed it. SWAT was in position. On three, we're green, Crawford whispered, his voice breaking the radio squelch in Victoria's ear. He counted slowly, deliberately, a man with ice water in his veins. At the count of three, the monitors were a blur of motion. Victoria's headset resounded with the simultaneous crash of the front and rear doors and the shattering of the sliding glass in the master bedroom. She braced for the crack of gunfire, but she heard only the shouts of Crawford and his team as they swept through the house and into the bedroom.
Down, down, get down on the floor!
Victoria stared at the night vision feed on the monitors, all images converging on the man on the mattress, the man going down, the man surrounded. There was a crackling on the radio, more commands. Monitor 1 showed a subject under control. The others flashed with the sweep of the house. Camera 5 was in the bathroom, where the infrared scan had detected warmth.
Nothing here, the agent reported.
Victoria looked more closely at the monitor. An empty bathroom. All clear, said Crawford. Victoria and her forensic specialist sprang into action and ran toward the house. Two tech agents were right behind her. Only the communications specialists remained behind. Victoria cut across the lawn at full speed. The patch of warmth was still a mystery, but if they had indeed found Cutter, Victoria didn't want some clever defense lawyer arguing that he had confessed to a crime with an M16 rifle pointed at his head. The front door was barely hanging on its hinges, damaged from the breach. She hurried inside. The tech agents followed SWAT to the subject's computer. Victoria and the forensic specialists went to the master suite. Crawford and two other agents were standing over a large man who was face down on the floor beside the bed. He was wearing only pajama bottoms and a white t-shirt. His hands were clasped behind his waist with plastic cuffs.
"Where is Angelina Beckham?"
Victoria shouted.
"I don't know,"
he said into the carpet.
"What did you do with her?" "Nothing. I don't know who you're talking about."
She wasn't sure he was lying.
"Santos got something,"
the forensic specialist said from the bathroom. Victoria hurried toward the bathroom. The forensic specialist was on the floor.
"Here's your heat source on the infrared," he said.
Victoria didn't see anything but white tile.
"What?" "Chemical cleaner," he said. "Some concentration of sulfuric acid or hydrochloric acid, which increases hydronium ions in a solution and attracts electrons from whatever mess you're trying to clean up. The hydronium ions react chemically with the material they're cleaning, which releases heat. Enough heat to be picked up by an infrared scan, if there's enough acid, and a big enough mess."
"What kind of mess?" He took his bottle of luminol and sprayed one of the ceramic floor tiles. Victoria switched off the light. The blue glow told the story.
blood, he said. From the amount of heat that showed up on the infrared scan, I'd say he was using one hell of a lot of chemical cleaners, wiping up a lot of blood. A SWAT agent entered the suite.
No body in the trunk of the car, he told Victoria. But the cadaver dog's going nuts. Our tipster from the gas station was right on.
Definitely was a body in there at some point. Let's get forensics on it, said Victoria.
Something else you need to see.
Victoria followed him out of the master bedroom, down the hall. Another agent opened the door and she entered what should have been the garage. Somehow she knew what she was about to see, but it still took her breath away.
Oh my God,
she said, stopping in the doorway.
The rear half of a two-car garage had been built out and converted into a windowless room. The walls and ceiling were painted black. The floor was unfinished concrete.
Three spotlights were mounted in the ceiling, their blinding beams targeting the very center of the room, where four sets of metal cuffs, two for the wrists, two for the ankles, were bolted into the concrete. The lighting was so tightly focused that the perimeter remained in the shadows, but there was just enough light to see the workbench against the wall. Slowly, Victoria walked toward it. The tools of a sadist came into view. Leather straps, bullwhips, pliers, scissors. Alligator clips, leashes, handcuffs, pins, and dildos of varying length and thickness, the largest about 18 inches. They were laid out meticulously across the bench. But it was the tool hanging on the wall right above the bench that distinguished this killer from so many other sociopaths who might have fit the criminal profile. It was a cane cutter's machete. Victoria felt a wave of something. Accomplishment, perhaps, summed it up. The tragedy of so many young victims made it impossible to call it success.
Got him, she said quietly.
Chapter 52.
It was a good half hour ahead of peak rush hour, cruising past the University of Miami campus in the first wave of morning commuters, heading to the Find Angelina Command Center, no plan in mind, just feeling like I needed to be doing something. The Dade Land Publix opened at 7, and I'd already been there and delivered three bags of groceries to JT's apartment, putting an end to the I got no food mantra. That was when Rid called from his house. Cutter is in custody. Countless questions clogged my mind, but I whittled the jumble of confusion down to the most important one.
What about Angelina?
We don't know.
My hands shook on the wheel. I had to pull off US-1 and park at a gas station, but I left the motor running.
You don't know if he took her, I asked, or he took her, and you don't know what he did with her.
The first one. Be glad for that, Abe. If this monster is in any way involved, there's not much doubt what he did.
I cranked the AC to max, anything to help me breathe again.
Who is he?
His name is Tommy Salvo. He works for Cortina Sugar.
My mouth fell open.
He works for the fucking sugar company? How could Santos not zero in on this guy sooner?
Keep in mind that the sugar industry has hundreds of thousands of employees and former employees. A computer search ruled him out in the first run through the database. Salvo has a house in Broward County, but he works and lives in Nicaragua during the harvest season, October to May. Apparently they still cut by hand there.
He actually is a cane cutter.
Nah, the cutting is done by very low-wage Nicaraguans. Salvo is an American citizen and has a supervisory role in field operations. Anyway, he slipped through the computer search because he has no criminal record, and immigration records showed that he was in Nicaragua at the time of the murders.
So he came back illegally.
Right.
The FBI's thinking is that he flew Managua, Havana, Nassau on Cuba jet, then paid someone under the table for a boat ride to the States from the Bahamas. A circuitous route, but if you're a serial killer who wants law enforcement to think you're out of the country, it's worth the effort. No one knew he was here.
Except,
I started to say, then stopped. Except who? Asked Ridd.
Except maybe Tyler Tompkins.
Could that be why she was calling me and leaving me messages on my voicemail? Ridd didn't answer me.
Did Salvo kill Tyler?
I asked. That's not clear.
That's a shitty answer.
Abe, my hands are tied as to what I can tell you. Santos is interrogating the suspect now. This is all very confidential.
Don't give me that confidential bullshit!
I shouted, my words a bolt of anger.
Knowing what happened to Tyler could mean the difference between finding and not finding my wife. Tell me what you know. Good, bad, everything. Fucking tell me, Ridd!
A soccer mom in an SUV pulled into the gas station and maneuvered toward the pump in front of me, the pack of kids in the rear seats. She drove right past the pump and steered back onto the highway. My windows were up, and I must have looked like a lunatic, yelling into my phone and pounding the steering wheel. Okay, here's what I know, he said. Salvo had his kill room set up like an amateur movie studio. Black walls, spotlights, soundproofing the whole bit. The FBI confiscated his computer, but Santos is being tight-lipped about what they found. It's a pretty safe bet that this sick son of a bitch liked to film what he did to his victims, but I have no idea if that means five women from Palm Beach County or if it means more than that. I don't want to lead you wrong with half-baked information. This could turn out to be good news for you, or it could be god-awful news. I practically fell forward, my forehead landing on the steering wheel. It was a struggle to talk.
Where's the interrogation?
FBI field office.
I'm going there.
It's pointless. Santos won't let you near the interrogation.
Ridd, I'm going up. Are you in the game or on the sidelines?
He hesitated, but only for a second. I'll let Carmen know your polygraph is off and meet you there. I hung up, put the car in drive, and said a prayer as I pulled out of the gas station and onto US 1.
Chapter 53.
Victoria knew she was going to break him.
Despite having led law enforcement to believe that he was in Nicaragua, Cutter was not a clever one. Victoria had spent the first 2 hours of the interrogation making him understand that there was no talking his way out of this. She had the goods to fry his ass. Then she and her partner had left the room, let him sit alone at the table and stare at the bare walls for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour. The two FBI agents watched from the viewing room behind the one-way mirror. With them were Bert Franklin and his partner, both homicide detectives from the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Department.
How much longer are you going to let him stew?
Asked Franklin. A few more minutes, she said.
This is a foolish strategy, he said. You let him sit much longer, he's going to demand a lawyer.
Franklin was still fuming over the fact that he was strictly an observer. The FBI had asserted jurisdiction based on reams of hardcore child pornography found on Cutter's computer, a federal offense. It was the hook that allowed Victoria to seize the lead in what otherwise would have been strictly a violation of state law, homicide. Victoria had invited Franklin and his partner as a professional courtesy to the multi-agency task force.
I got this covered, she said.
Victoria stepped closer to the one-way glass, studying her subject. Salvo was a big man, 6'3", well over 200 pounds, muscular but not like a gym rat. He had the physique and weathered look of a farmer who'd spent his life working the field.
His salt-and-pepper beard was not at all groomed, just the scruff of a man who didn't like to shave. A buzz cut made it less obvious that his hair was thinning. At 48, he was older than Victoria had profiled, which explained the Viagra they'd confiscated from his residence. Erectile dysfunction only partially explained the abundance of dildos, all black, all of which fit Victoria's profile of an angry white male who targeted white women with black boyfriends. Still like it, black bitch.
Phase two, said Victoria. It was time to go back inside. Victoria had done this many times before in so many cases. This was when the smart ones started to bargain.
I'll tell you where I dumped the five bodies you don't know about if you don't go for the death penalty.
Victoria didn't expect that from Cutter. He needed to show her how smart he was.
Look how many clues you missed, how I was right under your nose and laughing at your incompetence.
Cutter was a bragger. She could feel it. She laid a pack of Marlboros in front of him.
Cigarette?
He took it. She slid a lighter across the table and he lit up.
I knew you smoked, she said.
Good one, Sherlock. Was it the ashtrays all over my house or the cigarette cartons that tipped you off?
Bragger. It was the burn marks on your victims, she said.
He breathed out a cloud of smoke, saying nothing. Victoria methodically laid four autopsy photographs in front of him, four of the five Palm Beach County victims, excluding the one who had been burned beyond recognition in the field. Only their faces were in the photos.
But that's not cigarette ash smeared all over their faces, she said.
Is it?
He took another drag.
You know what it is.
Why don't you tell me?
He sat back, flicking his ash on the floor. Getting comfortable, thought Victoria.
Do you know why women used to be called the fair sex? He asked.
She knew it had to do with the archaic sense of beauty and purity. Mirror, mirror on the wall. But she wanted his view.
I've never really given it much thought.
It's because when you compare them to men, they really are fairer.
In what way? Asked Victoria.
Are you even trying to pay attention?
What do you think we're talking about here?
I mean their skin. There's a difference in pigmentation between men and women.
I would have thought it depends on the person.
That's because you're stupid, he said. And I'm much smarter than I look.
Talk to me, smart boy.
It's a chemical and molecular fact, he said. Obviously, it's not as dramatic as the difference between a black man and a white man. But if you compare a white man to a white woman or a black man to a black woman, the male has more melanin and hemoglobin. Men are darker. Women are paler. The female is the fair sex.
Victoria couldn't wait to see what this guy had been reading on the internet.
Is that so?
Don't talk down to me.
I'm not.
I see that look in your face.
You think I'm a Confederate flag-waving racist and card-carrying member of the Ku Klux Klan?
I didn't say that.
People think because I went into farming and didn't go to college, I couldn't hack it in school. I was actually a good student. Chemistry was my best subject.
Translation, you cooked meth.
And I've lived all over the world. Nicaragua, Dominican Republic, Brazil.
That's impressive.
I'm not trying to impress you. I'm making a point. My brain and what I see with my own two eyes tells me that skin color is less and less about race.
I'm not sure I understand what you just said.
Pay attention, will you? It's simple. You go to a place like Managua or Santo Domingo or Sao Paulo. Who the fuck knows what race these people are? Black, white, Hispanic, Indian, multiracial, whatever that means. Truth is, the labels are all bullshit. It's a thousand-year process, but the world is evolving into a single human race where skin color is important for one thing only, sex. The darker male is attracted to the lighter female. That's your theory? Not a theory. It's factual. That's why black men have always wanted our women. Does that make you angry? Not at all. I've been surrounded by dark-skinned men in the cane fields all my adult life. Got no problem with them. Physical attraction to the fair sex is completely natural. He leaned closer, the smoke from a cigarette trailing toward Victoria. What pisses me off is white women who want to pop out little brown babies. Victoria had heard enough. With the homemade videos of his victims on his computer, the physical evidence collected by the forensic team, and his demonstrated desire to fill the world with anthropological bullshit, Cutter was on his way to a very long sleep at the end of death row. It was time to see what he knew about the crimes outside of Palm Beach County. Victoria collected the victims' photographs and tucked them into the file. "There's another reason I knew you smoked," she said. "Aside from the burn marks on the victims, I mean." He crushed out his cigarette and lit another. "Is this part of your brilliant criminal profile? White male chain smoker?" She opened another file and laid a single photograph of Tyler Tompkins on the table. Not Tyler the victim. It was Tyler the lawyer, a professional black and white image from the BB&L website. "I saw you standing across the street from Tyler Tompkins' memorial service," said Victoria. He smiled. "That was you, wasn't it? That glowing orange dot in the overflow parking lot?" Silence. She leaned closer, staring him down from across the table. "Did you kill Tyler Tompkins?"
"Nope,"
he said, no hesitation.
"We would have liked to, though."
"What do you mean, we?"
"All of us in Nicaragua. She was part of the team of Miami lawyers who came over to bust our balls."
This wasn't a turn Victoria had expected. "Who else was on the team?"
"Bunch of suits. I don't remember."
"They came to bust your balls about what?"
"Everything. The whole cane-cutting operation in Nicaragua."
"What specifically?"
"Same old bullshit, labor issues."
"Ask the lawyers if you want to know more."
Victoria glanced at her partner, who made a note of it. They would ask the lawyers.
She laid another photograph on the table. It was a frame from the security camera at the restaurant in Orlando. Tyler having dinner with Abe Beckham. "Why did you send this to Angelina Beckham?"
"Who is Angelina Beckham?"
Victoria ignored his question. She laid a duplicate of the restaurant photograph on the table, right beside the other. But this one showed the smudge of ash on Tyler's face. "Angelina Beckham found these photos in her mailbox. I know it was you who sent them. That's your signature."
"My signature?"
Sugarcane ash on Tyler's face. He took a closer look, almost chuckling.
"Why would anyone smear black ash on a face that's already black?"